Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
That's kind of what we touched upon earlier, but for us, it was, you know, really at the end of the day, I ended up finding out that I was going to have to lay off all of our staff at Crush Pad, and so it's like, oh, it's really not a fun thing to do. I mean, I gathered them all up around
a vice president, right? The territory.
Exactly, and so it's not a fun thing to do. But then at least we had something that we'd been kind of cooking up to say, okay, if this happens, then we can go do this and let's fix these things and change it. And so it started off as just that, and then the business sort of evolved where it was a sustainable business, but in order to actually control our own destiny and buy our own facility, because we rented space at a custom crush facility in Sonoma in 2012 and 2013, and then we'd been looking for a winery to buy of our own. We got down to like the 5-yard line with one in particular that I think is a good thing it didn't work out, because it was too big a facility and too old of it just would have been a Yeah, it wouldn't have been fun.
A nightmare.
Totally.
yeah, me too.
So that shifted at the last minute, and we lost out on that, which I think that's for the better. And then we literally found this place that was, so our existing winery in 2014 was called The Juice Box. And The Juice Box was a custom crush facility, and they had one brand called Edict that was here. And so they decided they were going to sell the winery. They weren't selling the business, just the winery. And Patrick had worked with somebody that was the production manager here and bumped into him at a Stagecoach tasting. And literally like about 4 hours later, yeah. Philip and I were here looking at the facility because he texted us from the Stagecoach thing. And I think Stu, who is one of our other partners, just said, hey, the Juice Box is for sale, small custom crush place in Napa. And so Philip and I looked it up, basically kind of came right over a couple hours later. And I think we were at the point of an agreement going into escrow like 4 days later. And so
that's the timing part of it.
Exactly.
Yeah, and yeah, the exactly timing. What we were and talking about earlier. It just so happened that Garrett, the former production manager, the winemaker now at Adobe Road Winery, was the first cellar guy that I hired at my first winemaking gig, you know, eight years before, whatever. And so I hired Garrett, and then I see him at a tasting. I say, hey, Garrett, how's it going? No, not good. The owner wants to sell the place. And Stu hears that and goes, ooh. And then a few months later, we owned it. And so it's pretty amazing how
it's timing and relationships. And that's what, so really what then we realized is, okay, The Wine Foundry core product of selling wines by the barrel and incubating small brands, small, you know, commercial brands that are coming to us, not our own brands, is also tricky because it's very cyclical with, you know, a lot of the business is based on spec of where we're saying, okay, well, we have to get into contracts with these vineyards for, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. With certain blocks and certain tonnage. And so, but we're just doing that based on, okay, well, we think this same business is going to come back every year and the economy can be what it is and things can change and pivot. And so in order to insulate ourselves with that, we said, okay, well, we need to have custom crush. We want to have that also. And really at the end of the day, we want to have our own brands. And so that's what really led into last year when we launched the Anarchist Wine Co., which was, we have Foundry, which is more allocated. It's, you know, small production, kind of traditional varietal designates. We've been doing that since 2012, or at least bottling wine for it since 2012. But it was more kind of club only and really could only get it if you were a friend or family of us and didn't really ever market it. So we've grown that now to a few hundred cases, which is good. But the Anarchist Wine Co. is really what's kind of fun because it's sort of his playground. He gets to take, you know, we probably see 22, 24 varieties of grapes come through the door here. And about I don't know, 14 or 15 of them are things we contract. And so he gets to really kind of play and go against the grain and do things that you blend varieties together you don't normally see together. So he has fun doing that. We opened the tasting room about a year ago in the launch party where we met you guys. Mm-hmm. And so the tasting room over at the Village Napa Valley at the Vista Cleaner Resort, it's that brand is centered around really kind of well-priced but over-delivering on quality wines. And so currently, you know, I don't think we don't have any wine in that lineup that's over $50 a bottle, and that's including Napa fruit and all of that. And so it's a low margin brand and more of a volume play, but really quality driven. And it's what we think is it's a fun thing to do for the six of us that are partners in the brand. Mm-hmm. And it's also, I think, really kind of creative to just, you know, it is great making Napa Cab. Napa Cab is awesome, mm-hmm. you know, or this Cab Franc that I'm going to drink here in a second, is incredible and it's gorgeous. But it's also really great to just have some creativity and remind ourselves why we're doing this in the first place, you know?
You clearly had the opportunity and
that's right.
you wanted to express.
Well, the fun part, as I mentioned earlier, I've now made, you know, after making for the last decade, now literally a decade at making somewhere between, you know, 100 and 300-ish probably or more wines per year, a lot of wines in the last 10 years alone. That and most of them are more, I'd say, more traditional, and that some of them have been crazy blends or whatever. But in general, the more traditional, Cab or a Pinot, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, or whatever the client wants or that we would want. And I think that's quite. I'm a traditionalist, so that's fine. That, but being that I've also kind of done so many traditional wines, it was really fun to come up with some, on paper at least, kind of crazy blends. And so many people would look at it and go, you know, the Anarchist white wine that we make, the Anarchist is the kind of the flagship of the wines, whatever, the white blend. In the first year, I co-fermented Gewürztraminer and Chenin Blanc and Riesling. And then I blended in smaller amounts of Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, and Viognier.
So sounds like Franken wine.
It's a bit of a Franken wine, but it wasn't just like a Frank. So, by the way, I've made a number of Franken wines, and so I get the Franken wine. And most of the Anarchist wines, and certainly on paper, do seem definitely Franken wine esque. In this case, you know, I'm blending, you know, intentionally, not just because I have X amount of Sauvignon Blanc left or X amount of this. This is because I wanted a profile. And quite frankly, in the case of the Anarchist, the profile is more Alsatian in style. I really like wines from Alsace. And Pinot Gris or Gewürz or Riesling or Pinot Blanc can be grown in the Alsace. But they don't grow Chenin there, and don't grow Chardonnay and Viognier and Sauvignon Blanc there, and so and that just because what the French do, whatever. But it's in general, when people are making wines, they typically would not put that combination together. So it's a blend that's never been done before, as far as I know. And so I just found that to be really fun, particularly when it really works. It is a, and then we made a few other wines. I wanted to do some fun with the rosé. I wanted to have a fun rosé this year. We did Tempranillo and Mourvèdre together. I put a little bit of Garnacha and Pinot and Cab in there too. Again, just varietals that you typically wouldn't necessarily put together from different portions.
But how does it come together in your mind?
Like, yeah.
What compels you to put Tempranillo in the blend?
Yeah, so that's a good question. It's that it's not something, so I love, to, by the way, I love Tempranillo. And so, particularly when I think it's done in a way that it's mostly attractive, I find it really like more. I want the Tempranillo, like Grenache, to be lighter and prettier and more acid-driven.
Why that particular composition? How does
yeah.
that...
Yeah, well, work? I was looking for, so, and the reality was, I was looking for a something that you wouldn't have normally have thought, necessarily. So I was kind of looking for an out-of-the-box...
And the wine, it was and for so, the wine, Rosé Against the Machine.
And so the name of the wine is called Rosé Against the Machine.
Of course.
And so it has an outside-of-the-box name. And I want to, and the brands in general, as I said before, and as Steve mentioned, the Anarchist, all the wines are a bit out of the box. And we have another wine called the Skeptic, which is an orange wine, mm-hmm. which is a white wine. An orange wine is a white wine that's made like a red wine. So white wine is made on the skins. In this case, for the 18 vintage, Pinot Blanc. Another one I did was Gewurztraminer and Chenin Blanc together, co-fermented together, which again is very strange, perhaps, to somebody. In this case, Pinot Blanc, that's a fairly neutral skin quality, but you pick up all the texture and tannins and grip that you would get from the skins. And that makes, when you taste the white wine with texture and tannins and grip and bitterness, it throws your palate off a little bit. It makes you think, what's, you know, it's not what you'd expect. Now, this wine now has been bottled for 6 months or so. An orange wine changes dramatically over it, even the first year of its life. So if you like a wine to be really unique and different and kind of bitter and aggressive or more aggressive on the palate, you need to try it earlier on its shelf life, right after bottling, because that's when it's going to be most aggressive on the palate, usually with the orange wine especially. And so I made this wine to be aggressively different, but now it's been in the bottle for 6 months and it's softened somewhat. So the bitterness is gone to the background, and the palatability, if you will, has probably come to the foreground a little bit more. So the wine is more, you still pick up the tannins and texture, and
the aromatics come through pretty nice.
Aromatics are still there. Yeah, the aromatics are still there. The bitterness has dropped significantly. And so what was, I think, a bit, perhaps a little too aggressive early on, but definitely interesting, has now become more palatable, as I said, for most people's palate, at least. And so it depends on where you fall on the spectrum of palates.
Yeah.
If you are a new world palate, you probably want less of the bitterness and funkiness, if you will, or old worldness to shine through in the profile. So you probably either prefer an orange wine, you just need more time in bottle aging, or perhaps a different orange wine, perhaps. You know, so the
orange wine became a darling of the trade.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say that it's still a bit of
you know what, all wines, including red wines and white wines, were orange wines previously, because, you know, before, in the last really probably 100 years, before that, all white wines were orange wines. They weren't done whole cluster pressed with removing the skins and leaving like that.
That's a big one right there. Yeah.
All white wines were orange wines previously. Yeah.
Wow.
So you go back.
Certainly far enough, but it's been in the last century for sure, you know, that we've gone to, I don't know the exact date, but it's been, it's a modern, you know, where most people now like white wines to have less of that quality, have no skin quality. So you immediately dump it in the press and you separate it and segregate it quickly to minimize the skin impact on the wine. So if you want more skin impact, you leave it in contact. If you don't, you don't. And so it just matters the style of the wine. So orange wine is because more and more people are realizing that there is a ton of wine styles out there. We tend to like we as the New World particularly, likes this fairly narrow range of profiles of varietals and or styles of varietals. Like you can make Pinot Blanc very light and pretty, you know, separate the skins and make it tank fermented, or you can leave it on the skins and do an orange wine out of it and get more impact on those skins. And so depending on what you find is, you know, what you're trying to do, I said for the wine called The Skeptic, we wanted to make it a different kind of wine. We also bottled for Foundry, we bottled a Pinot Blanc that was done more traditionally. And so tank fermented and so separated from the skins and has none of that skin impact. So totally different kind of wines, and depending on, and may or may not appeal to the same person. And so
it's a little bit harder to love because it has so much more impact and the bitter qualities.
Yeah,
and there's so much. What I love about the kind of, I guess, resurgence, as you were saying, of an orange wine or a skin fermented white, is that you're getting a lot of different interpretations in the market, and so you have like Scribe does most of their wines are pretty acid driven anyway, but it's a really, they're on the skins, I think, 6 months. At least that's what the label says.
Yeah, and they probably put it into terracotta or something. They're putting it into amphora or something like that.
Which is totally cool. That's one take. And then we've got our take. And I know Tank does Skin Flick that they just recently released, which I haven't had yet, but I can imagine it's a bit different. But it's just not fun. You
yeah,
know,
so the orange like wines really are for more for people thing. That are a bit more adventurous or that want to have something
more intellectual,
a bit
intellectual.
Perhaps more intellectual, but certainly yeah. more adventurous either way. Yeah. They're definitely looking for not the average experience. And so
well, that, for us, that wine is actually named after Patrick because.
Yeah. I was, Philip, I'm the skeptic. Yeah, Philip, no, I didn't want to make it. I didn't. I was the.
Our partners, Philip and Val, they were down at Post Ranch Inn back in 2014 or 15, maybe 15, I think. And they had a, I think it was Trebbiano. It was an Italian wine. Mm-hmm. But I think the grape was Trebbiano. Is that right, Patrick?
I think so.
And they came back just raving about it. Okay, we've got to do an orange wine. This is this new thing. They hadn't really seen or heard of it before. And Patrick's like, and it was literally, I think they were there for like Val's birthday or something, which is in August. So they come back right on the cusp of harvest telling Patrick, we need to do an orange wine. He's like, I don't need to do this.
I'm good. Yeah, no, I'm all set.
I don't want another
yeah.
thing on my list. Not at all. And so they were like, you're just too skeptical. It's going to be great. And so we
the first wine, but what was tough for me was the first wine we made. And this, I think that the Pinot Blanc, it makes a very good version of it. The Chenin Blanc Gewurztraminer version of this wine was incredible. And so aromatically was probably the most amazing wine I've ever smelled, even though I'm not just saying because I made it. It was just amazing. And then a lot of the aromatics falls out over time and the bitterness goes away and becomes more and more, you know, kind of, again, palatable, if you will, toward the mainstream. And so, but because it was so good, because it worked out so well, they're like, well, you got to keep making it then, of course. So that was too bad that we did a good version of it the first time, you know, like, and yeah, that's a good point.
It did take him 2 years to agree to do it.
I don't like to do something just because it was on point or something like that. Now just because it was on fashion.
And that's so interesting to me because even though it's considered fashionable, you made a point that it actually is as old as the world. I mean, let's talk about Georgian wines.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's your orange wine that's centuries old. That's arguably some.
It just becomes in fashion again at some point because most people again it fell out of fashion because it's hard to it's not as easy on the palate.
It's not as easy to love, but the thing is, particularly
for new world palates that don't grow up with bitterness being so prevalent in the. Desirable in the culture, so there's a small subset of the population that likes bitter, that likes dark chocolate, that likes grapefruit, and that likes bitter things. But most people prefer less of that, and so particularly New World.
But I think it's worth giving yourself a chance.
Right,
I think so. Most people that
skeptic to try it.
Totally.
Who knows?
Most people, the
first time we did it, I think we did like 70 cases of it or so. And then for the Anarchist brand this year, I think we did maybe 90 or 100 cases of, you know, something like that. A ton and a half of fruit or something, right? And so that's one of the nice things about being, you know, we kind of almost are this nice little microcosm where we can play and experiment and do things on a small level to see how they go. And for the Anarchist brand, this is a... It's only available in our tasting room and to wine club members to buy online. So we can kind of play with that, and it's been tremendously popular. So we'll do it again.
You're gonna have to do it again this year.
Of that wine.
Filing now.
We have kind of four core products that we distribute: Rosé Against the Machine, the Anarchist that you mentioned, a wine called Conspiracy Theory, which we're really pushing hard to be like the official wine of the Area 51, like storming the gates or whatever.
51, yeah, yeah.
Actually, on our Instagram profile, it's kind of fun. We're doing like 51 different conspiracy theories for 51 days.
I love your Instagram feed. You guys need to check it out. Seriously, it's one of the funnest accounts.
Thanks.
Cool. It is fun. Thank you.
We try to have fun with it. It's supposed to be fun, and it's supposed to be a fun wine. And then the Philosopher, which is our cab-driven Napa red blend. Mm-hmm. But those are the four core that are in distribution, and mostly, and then Rage Against the Machine, which is probably my favorite wine in the lineup right now, at least. It changes every few weeks. I know, but I have a different favorite. You know, I only have one kid. I have an almost 8-year-old daughter, and so he has three kids. He could speak better to actually choosing favorites, because I don't have a choice.
It's hard. It depends on the day.
Of course. So how did you build your following? I mean, you mentioned business acumen and picking up from the lessons, that became Foundry, you know, but crush pad. Consumer, what is your plan? How did you build that momentum with the end user?
For are we talking the Wine Foundry or Anarchist? Wine Foundry?
Anarchist. Well, actually, we can talk about both.
Okay. But. So with the Wine Foundry, Crushpad had kind of a built-in client base for us, right? And it was a very tumultuous thing. That changeover, a lot of clients had given money to Crushpad and paid their money, and other things weren't paid. And so we had the very difficult task of stepping in and saying, okay, I know you think you paid for this wine, but there's actually like either fruit wasn't paid for, or you need to also pay to finish the wine because there is no more money. Like we subsidized it by about 40%, but if we were gonna pay for everybody to be able to finish their wine that was in process through that process, there's no investor in the world that would have come into that for just like fingers crossed, let's hope that we have a go forward business afterward. But we ran a very transparent transition and kind of startup of our business. We asked a few clients from different walks of the Crushpad arena to be on kind of an advisory board so that we could really talk to them and tell them, this is what we're doing, this is what we're thinking, what do you think? And took a lot of feedback in. Some clients, you know, they just saw black and white and or maybe red for rage and said, you know, no, you just, I paid for my wine, I want to get it and just give it to me and whatever. And so, you know, we dealt with this stuff, but most of them were very, I think, pleased that all of us were answering our phones, communicating clearly and transparently. And so that
and
really
providing a path forward.
Yeah, and giving them a path forward that nobody else could really do. You know, that's a very good point. And so because of that, I think that it earned respect and kind of a nice relationship with these people to say, okay, look, we're not hiding anything. We're saying this is how we can do it. This is what happened. This is what we can do. And they were okay with it. And it gave them a path forward, like you said. And a lot of these people had invested a lot of money in you know, small, like 50 to 300 or 400 case brands that they were incubating through that program. Cause we do have a kind of commercial platform to where we can take their brand commercial and they really market it and we take care of all the kind of back office and production and all of the stuff that nobody else wants to do. So that really gave us like a good base of business to go forward. And from there forward, it's really, if you Google I want to make my own wine or I want to, we're kind of the only game in town to do it with the level of vineyards that we're partnered with and we contract with and
customization,
and
quality, you know, and quality,
the level,
so there's a handful of wineries or people, depending on your connections. If you knew someone at a winery, you might be able to make a wine at a or someone might sell you a barrel of wine, but they're not going to let you put in 2% Petit Sirah, 1% you know, Cab Franc, and 3% Merlot into it just to finish it off and complete and make your own label and so forth. So for anyone that really, and then quite frankly, I think since then also from starting that up, the way that we've maintained the business and or made more is by changing the process and guaranteeing kind of quality, you know. And so we have, you know, Crushpad did a lot of great things and it kind of invented this process. I think, and for any of the Crushpad people listening, that we've taken the model and perfected or made it even, you know, much stronger and better, primarily by taking some examples of, you know, learning lessons of what they've done, not only on production, but on the business itself, on that way we set up the contracts, the way we've organized the structure of the company in itself. And so there's a lot of details that bore you onto the actual company structure, which why we've succeeded, but also to the wine quality. We've invested in, you know, some of the best tanks you could possibly have and some of the best processing equipment. And all the tanks are, you know, networked in. We have temperature control at all points and things like that. So it wasn't just by mistake that we've gotten the quality we've gotten. We've partnered with top vineyards. And Crushpad was already doing a lot of these same things, but we took even a lot of those, you know, lessons that we've learned from their model.
And we take it to 11.
And we took it to at least 11, maybe 21. I don't know. It's a lot more than what they had, for sure. And so, It's definitely what it is, but we've also guaranteed quantity quality better. We've, you know, across the board, one of the hard parts Steve alluded to is when you have hundreds of ferments going at the same time, is making all those hundreds of wines of the same quality. You don't want something lower quality for some of them, a higher quality for others. You want it to be across the board for everyone to get this comparable quality experience. And so the, just like it is at a, and I used the analogy earlier with you at the restaurant, is if we had, and with someone earlier as well, with if you're making hundreds of dinners at the same time and they're all customized, it's very, very, very difficult to make sure that all of them are the quality at the same level. And so if you were paying for dinner or you're paying for your wine, you want the exact same quality that you could expect at somebody else. And so to do it concurrently, incredibly difficult. And that's why that very few to no one else is trying to do what we're doing, is because of the difficulty level of it.
And you have no gray hair.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. you're bearing costs. You had your eyes closed when you said that, of course. But the we're literally making. I said we have hundreds of wines currently. We've already bottled this year, whatever, 200, 300 wines, and then to keep that going, and we got another harvest coming. And it's a ambitious, as I said before, ambitious model, but with a lot of rewards to it, because hundreds of people across the world get to make their custom wines from Stagecoach Vineyard or Georgia Third Vineyard or other, you know, very high end that you wouldn't have access to, and you wouldn't be able to do, and or would cost you a lot more money to be able to even to buy these bottles, much less to be able to access your own blends and have.
So what I'm hearing is that you would take equal care of just maybe a simple Sauvignon Blanc from, say, for the heck of it, Lake County, as you would from George III.
Yeah, no, I have no less. No, very good. That's an excellent question. Actually, I think I have no less pride or goal in mind and quality wise for that $20 Sauvignon Blanc than I would for that $120, $220 George III Cab. And so, to me, it obviously takes a lot longer and a lot more steps involved to get to for the Cab, just because of the way mostly of the processing. Mm-hmm. Decisions and wine style, but Sauvignon Blanc, to me, I want you to enjoy it. Again, it'd be comparable quality. It's just a different experience. And so value them. Yeah.
But earlier we were kind of talking about timing and being in the right place at the right time. And also, I think I mentioned something about relationships also being a factor there, that it's everybody, I think, whether consumer or client of ours or, you know, customer buying wine anywhere, for the most part, somebody that's into wine has a relationship with it, and that's the coolest part about it, is that, you know, that's actually what I loved about being a brewer when I was at Gordon Biersch, and what I love about being in this industry, is that you've got something tangible that at the end of the day, like, somebody's going to go home, and if they buy a bottle of our wine and they go home and they, you know, whether they have friends over for dinner, whether they get in an argument with their husband or wife, or maybe they have a great night of sex, it doesn't matter. Like, we're in there somewhere, and it's a tangible product that we've kind of brought to the table. That's what's cool, is that you're perpetuating, you're a function in a relationship. And so whether it is Sauvignon Blanc or, you know, one of the arguably top New World Cab vineyards in the world, you got to take care of that, you know.
That's an interesting.
Sorry if I.
No, it's just a separate podcast. I'm thinking, how do you facilitate great sex?
Yeah,
I'm
there
sure
you go.
I have lots of
this is definitely the adult version. This is for the kids that have gone to bed now. I've said actually before. It's interesting. That's somewhat kind of a tangential to that. I felt that I took a lot of satisfaction in knowing that. Somehow, working with all these clients that we work with through the Wine Foundry, that I am somehow part of all these different events and dinners and evenings with friends.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.